Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am so grateful for the opportunity to speak for the next few minutes with the author of a truly fascinating book called Leonardo's Legacy, How Da Vinci Reimagined the World. We, of course, are talking about the extraordinary Leonardo da Vinci, a painter, artist, designer, engineer of sorts, whose legacy is still being grappled with. And we are still trying to come to terms with this amazing genius. And the new book that we're going to be talking about for the next few minutes explores not only the ways in which Leonardo da Vinci was amazingly ahead of his time, but also some of the ways in which da Vinci was also a part of his time. That is, although he was certainly, probably in many respects, the most important luminary of his time in these various fields, he by no means was alone. He was coming to prominence in an era of amazing discovery and one tremendous breakthrough after another. That's also important for us in understanding just exactly who he was and how he came to accomplish what he did. The book is written by Stefan Klein, who is an important writer with a number of different things to his credit, including the bestseller The Science of Happiness, also The Secret Pulse of Time. He makes his home in Berlin, Germany, and from Germany he is speaking to us today on the Morning Show about his book. We should probably mention that it was originally written in German and translated by Shelley Frisch. The book is a publication of Da Capo Press, generously annotated with notes and many, many illustrations by the great Da Vinci himself. Stefan Klein, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Hello.
So glad to have this chance to talk with you. Could you explain to us how you first became intrigued with Leonardo da Vinci and began studying him in earnest?
Well, I was intrigued by him very early on, when really badly done but still beautiful print of one of his graphics fell into my hand when I was still at high school. So the print just showed I can begin that under 10 grand, right? So the print just shows water pouring into a tub, as it would in your bathtub or as it would when you're pouring a cup of tea. And Da Vinci makes clear that this seemingly so everyday process is full of extraordinary detail. So you would see bubbles popping up, currents of all kinds. Actually, the graphic looks as if Leonardo had X-ray eyes. And this really amazed me, as I said, very early on with 17 years or so, because I thought, hey, look, you just have to look carefully enough, and the most everyday things are full of wonder for the one who looks. Now, Da Vinci puzzled and fascinated me kind in the back of my head for, well, almost 30 years since. But it really took a long time until I dared to write a book about him, because I was kind of timid, you see. If I would really have the courage to near myself to such a great mind. And then eventually, a couple of years ago, I was invited to give a lecture in Milan, and I went into the National Museum dot, which is called Leonardo da Vinci. And there I saw all those models of the machines he made, and I was so fascinated, and I just couldn't resist the temptation.
Well, I'm glad that you gave into the temptation. You've created a marvelous book. One of the things I especially love is the way the book begins. The introduction is titled "The Mystery of the 10,000 Pages," and you take us to the year 1520, and a really interesting story, which begins actually maybe a year or so after Leonardo da Vinci had died. Tell our listeners at least a little bit of this really quite dramatic and moving story with which your book begins.
Well, the story is that Leonardo literally wrote and drew down everything that went through his head, and that was really a lot. So, over this more than 60 years he lived, he amassed more than probably 10,000 manuscript sheets, a horrible mess. And he always wanted to publish at least part of it, for example, his extraordinary anatomical drawings, but he never made it. Probably not because he was so busy with millions of other things. So, when he died at the court of the King of France, whose guest and friend he was, he gave all his heritage to his beloved pupil and private secretary, Melzi, who was a young man at that time, and he took that 10,000 pages home to his native Italy. That's with that journey my book begins. And for his lifetime, Melzi hoarded this treasure in his private villa. But eventually Melzi died, and his son didn't know what to make out of it. And this is where the tragedy begins, because the son gave Leonardo's drawings away to anybody who wanted to have them. And this is how literally the important works of Leonardo were torn apart like confetti, and at the end reigned over various libraries and collections all over Europe. Now some are even in the U.S. in the meantime. And by this very fact, that this work was torn apart and more probably the half of it was lost, this is one reason why Leonardo da Vinci is so enigmatic today. Because it's only in the last years that scholars have started to reconstruct these manuscripts as they were, and they really continue to learn a lot from them, and lots is still not properly understood.
Hmm. One of the things you say in this introduction is that even the plunderers did not diminish Leonardo's posthumous fame. If anything, the gaps in Leonardo's story created openings for myths. In other words, the fact that so much of what he left behind is unfortunately lost to us, or up until now at least seems to be, in some ways makes him a still more intriguing figure for us.
Of course, because this gives room for all kinds of imagination. Think of the smash hit book of Dan Brown, who really capitalized on how Leonardo is suitable as a screen for all kinds of projections we have. By the way, this is not an entirely new phenomenon. Already at his lifetime and shortly after, Leonardo was a kind of, a mysterious figure and a pop star at the same time. When he displayed some of his early sketches for some of his drawings, the people would crowd together to see them. So that an artist would become a star was a really new phenomenon at that time. So we are not the first ones to kind of idealize Leonardo da Vinci.
Mm. Tell us a little bit more about the problem with having this collection scattered as it is. I mean, the fact that it was sold off to all kinds of different people. I mean, we've already touched on the most important loss, which is that so much of it ultimately just sort of disappeared from the face of the earth, or seems to have disappeared and perhaps been lost forever. But just the fact that the collection was dismantled has made it, of course, a great challenge then for scholars like yourself to try to understand sort of each and every piece of what he drew and sketched and so on. Just explain what we would know if all of this material had never been split apart, if it had been kept together. What kind of a difference would that make for somebody like yourself, or somebody like us, trying to understand Da Vinci?
Well, it would be probably be much less interesting, but still interesting enough. I give you an example, not from my own research, but from the research of an engineer who happens to work quite near your place, namely in Minneapolis. Now, he, together with a very accomplished Leonardo scholar, found out that several sheets who were torn apart, one half of them being in Milan, the other half of them being in the collection of the Queen of England in Windsor Castle today, could not be understood at all, because they simply made no sense until they found out how to put them together by all kinds of really ingenious work, comparing the quality of the paper, comparing the ink, etc., etc. And so they found out that those pieces that could not be understood at all by themselves, the one shows a kind of human figure, the other one shows very mysteriously, seemingly, buckets of water. But when you put it together, you can understand that the whole thing is a project for a clockwork, and a clockwork that works in an unheard of way, namely, it's a project for a digital clockwork driven by water. But you would see what Leonardo wanted to do only if you put the puzzle together. It is really like a work of puzzle, you see? One piece alone doesn't make much sense. But once you put it together, you see the meaning.
So in other words, sometimes we will have maybe pages that should be seen side by side, next to each other, or that are talking about the same thing, but they might be located now in different hemispheres.
Exactly.
So another thing that is, of course, a great mystery about much of what Da Vinci left behind is that he engaged, for some reason, in a strange kind of mirror writing.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure many of our listeners have at least heard a little bit about this, as have I, but before reading your book, I never really understood anything about that. Explain why Leonardo da Vinci engaged in this sort of special kind of writing. Was there a particular purpose to it?
No, I think it's much less mysterious than one might think it is. We know that he was a left-hander, We know that he was a non-conformist, so it didn't matter, conventions didn't matter much to him, and it was simply faster for him to write that way, and from his manuscript we know that he wrote and most of all thought very fast. So his mirror writing has nothing to do with secrecy, that kind of things. It has many times been speculated that his mirror writing has to do with secrecy, but this is simply not true, because it was very obvious to Leonardo how easily one could decipher a writing that goes from left to right. Namely, you just put it in front of him. How to decipher a writing that goes from right to left? Namely, you just put it in front of a mirror. So Leonardo coded, indeed, rarely some things, but he did it in a completely different way. He would use a code of mixing up letters.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Stefan Klein, and we're talking about his book, Leonardo's Legacy, How Da Vinci Reimagined the World. As you said about studying Da Vinci and his legacy, one of the things that you had to do is try to see as much of this material for yourself as you possibly could. Could you just explain to our listeners where this effort ultimately took you? To what places around the world did you travel in order to see the legacy of Da Vinci with your own eyes?
Well, the farthest place is from the farthest place to which I traveled from my home place in Berlin was indeed Minneapolis, because I couldn't resist the temptation to meet Mark Rosheim's reconstruction of that digital clockwork driven by water. Else, the nearest place was the State Library of Berlin, which has a fabulous collection of facsimiles, a complete collection of facsimiles of all Leonardo manuscript pages. And in between, I traveled to Italy many times, of course, because I am convinced, as you said in your introduction, that Leonardo has to be understood from his context, that is, from the time he lived in and from the places where he lived. So actually, I visited all the places where Leonardo had lived and worked and died, of course. I went to France. And a truly remarkable, outstanding experience for me was that I was allowed to visit the private collection of the graphics of the Queen of England, as I said, in Windsor Castle near London. And there I had a day all on my own with Leonardo's drawing. This was truly fantastic, because it gives you a kind of romantic illusion to be alone with the master, and that for some hours you can speak to the master. I wouldn't have thought that I would be susceptible to that kind of thought, but I am. And when you can study some drawings in that detail, as you can there, you find that they are even more remarkable than anything you would see in the facsimiles or when you see them at an exhibition. This was really a fantastic experience.
You mentioned this encounter in the first chapter of the book, which is called The Gaze, G-A-Z-E, The Gaze. And it is in this chapter that you speak at length about his wonderful masterpiece, The Mona Lisa. And I'm so intrigued that you find new things to say, new insights to share about a painting, which, of course, has been the subject of all kinds of discussion and speculation and analysis over the centuries. And yet there is still more for us to learn about this intriguing painting. For instance, you tell us something about how Leonardo da Vinci was tremendously intrigued and by and studied the human face and facial expressions. Tell us more about how he explored this aspect of human beings.
Yeah, you see, I think that with Leonardo, you really cannot separate his art from his science. It was one and the same for him. And I think that the fact that Leonardo was indeed a pioneer of modern science also made him such an extraordinary artist. And I think the Mona Lisa is an excellent example for this. Leonardo, for example, tried to find out how we produce facial expressions. He went so far as to speculate about the acting of nerves. And, of course, he did many anatomical studies of the muscles in the face which would produce these expressions. He would do this with dissecting dead corpses, of course. And he indeed used all that knowledge he gained from his scientific research in his artistic work, as in the Mona Lisa. And the fact that the expression of the Mona Lisa is so mysterious for us comes from Leonardo making her very deliberately ambiguous. And I think one can show that very well.
Mm. You share a term that I had not ever seen before I read your book, an effect known as sfumato.
Uh-huh. Sfumato is a voluntary blurring of light and shadow, because Leonardo had found out that our perception, in fact, does not work like a photographic camera, for example. So what Leonardo does, he mimics the working of our perception in his paintings. So he would not paint what he sees, but rather he would paint what he knows about the workings of our perception. And in the Mona Lisa, for example, he uses this very deliberately to put his blurring in the parts of the face which we mostly use to read a facial expression. From neuropsychological research today, we know that people would look mostly at the eyes and at the cheek of people, at the regions around the ends of a mouth, to find out how he or she thinks and feels. And this is precisely where Leonardo puts in the Mona Lisa his most ambiguous shades. So it's not by chance at all that when looking at the Mona Lisa, we are puzzled.
I want to read just a moment from this chapter. This is what you write. Still more remarkable is how the light pours over Mona Lisa's body and plays with her fingers, each of which is finely shaded like a miniature sculpture. The hands project far forward to counterbalance the landscape in the distance, which augments the painting's sense of depth. The folds of the sleeves sparkle like sunbeams on the waves of the sea. Most importantly, the illumination makes Mona Lisa appear both animated and mysterious. The distribution of light and shadow foils any attempt to construe her frame of mind. Obviously, Leonardo calculated the brightness of each and every square inch of his painting, to achieve a particular effect. Nevertheless, no detail seems contrived or calculated. The light that falls on the young woman appears quite natural. I am so glad that you go into that kind of detail for us, because when we look at a painting like this and it appears entirely natural, we also would mistakenly assume that to achieve that would be a simple, natural matter. And of course, you point out that it's quite the opposite, that it was only attention to painstaking detail that allowed Da Vinci to paint such a natural-looking portrait that seems almost alive to us.
Yeah, indeed. And there is a drawing, a kind of pre-study for the Mona Lisa, which I was lucky to see in the libraries in Windsor, where you actually see how he did this. He uses geometrical constructions to determine the intensity of light under different angles. We see a face that under different angles. He uses geometrical constructions to determine the intensity of light depending on the angle under which it hits a face. You really can show that he really constructed every detail of it. So Leonardo's paintings have very little to do with the art of painting at his time, and it has even less to do, of course, with simple reproduction, with photography. But if you think of it, you rather have to think of it as being constructed like the images in a computer animation we are using today. They would use some of the very same methods Leonardo used to make, for example, his Mona Lisa appear so natural.
I also appreciate that in this chapter you draw a contrast between the Mona Lisa and this painting from about the same time, Lady with a Unicorn, by Raphael, which would be an example of a painting which is beautiful in its own way, but far more sterile in a sense. And just by showing us a painting like that, of a comparable sort of subject matter, but with an entirely different, lesser effect, it helps us appreciate the Mona Lisa all the more.
Greg, may I interrupt you at the moment?
Yes.
There is a child crying. Do you hear that?
I do not hear it at all, actually.
But I do, and it kind of it's my daughter. Hang on a moment.
Yep, you bet.
It kind of Dora.
Yep.
Dora, was ist denn los? Ja, ich mache hier gerade ein Radiointerview. Das ist ein bisschen schwierig. Kann sie woanders bitte? Okay, she hurt her finger. Okay.
Oh, is she okay?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay.
So we were at the Lady with the Unicorn, right?
Yes, that's right. Go ahead.
Can you ask your question again?
We were just talking about how the one painting is beautiful in its own way, but not nearly so lifelike. And it helps,
exactly,
by talking about the one we greater appreciate, the Mona Lisa.
Yeah. Despite that Raphael's Lady with a Unicorn is a much more beautiful woman, I'm sorry to have to say, being a male, it is a perfect painting. It's at the state of the art of the time. Raphael of Santi was a true master, but despite all of its beauty, Raphael's painting is cold. Now, we know that Raphael was inspired by the Mona Lisa. He saw the earliest sketches for the Mona Lisa, and he copied many inventions that Leonardo made for the Mona Lisa, namely the posing of the young lady at the veranda. the landscape in the background, even up to the posing of the hands. But still, everybody would know the Mona Lisa, and nobody would know about, or only experts would know about the Lady with the Unicorn. You don't know even where it is. It's in the Villa Borghese in Rome. And I think that that is due to the very fact that Raphael painted what he saw and Leonardo painted what he knew. I think that makes all the difference.
Later in the book, you tell us about something else which fascinated Leonardo da Vinci quite a lot. And it is namely the other aspects of the human body besides just the face and how facial expressions are created. This also happens to be an interest of his which gets him in some trouble. Could you explain what the attitude was in that day about the dissection of corpses and the study of the human body and what kind of trouble Leonardo da Vinci found himself in?
Well, the attitude at the time was kind of hypocrite, if you wish. So, officially, dissecting corpses was strictly forbidden by the church. It was banned. But, as always, there were exceptions. So medical students had limited access to corpses. And so did the artists. It was quite usual at that time that artists of great standing, as Leonardo was, of course, and many others were, made a kind of deal with the church. The deal with, would be, you produce for us brilliantly and naturalistically looking human corpses, and we won't ask how you gained that knowledge. And gaining that knowledge, of course, meant dissecting in the hospital, which many artists did. Now, the difference between Leonardo and his colleagues was that other painters would dissect only superficially. That is, to learn more about the muscular tissue and how it would model the human corpse. Leonardo would go much more into depth. For pure curiosity, he went to dissect inner organs, even the heart, and he showed fetuses. And that got him into trouble, because he even went beyond that. He speculated about the soul of the unborn child and the mother, etc. And the church couldn't want this. So he was betrayed by an employee of his, and we know from a note in his diaries, it didn't have serious consequences because he stood on good terms with the powerful, but he was banned from further access to the hospital, and that was painful for him.
Mm. One of the things you write about Leonardo in this particular chapter, which you title Under the Skin, is Leonardo was a consummate explainer, and he was convinced that pictures can offer a better overview than language. And indeed, when we look at the images that he created of things like the human shoulder or the human heart, it's really extraordinary how beautiful these are, and I'm sure at the time tremendously helpful for people wanting to understand the human body and its inner workings.
Well, they could have been helpful if Leonardo only had cared to publish them, what he always wanted to do. Had he done this, we would appreciate him today as the founder of modern anatomy, but he didn't. His nearly complete atlas of the human anatomy was forgotten, as so much of his works. But you are right to say that his graphics, of course, are fantastic, and they are entirely modern. In fact, Leonardo, all of his own, invented all the ways we still use to explain things graphically, all the views, all the dissections. He even went so far as to show sections through human corpses, which are physically entirely impossible, that he ever could have made that section. I just skipped that sentence.
It gets complicated, doesn't it? There are two other facets.
Yeah, and I have to finish soon.
Okay. Two other quick things to talk about briefly. I think many people who read your book will be surprised to see a chapter titled Robots. But indeed, Leonardo da Vinci came up with some of his most intriguing ideas in some of the amazing devices which he designed and in some cases produced. Explain how Leonardo da Vinci made his living, at least for some of his life, by, in your words, conjuring up dreams and illusions. Tell us some of these which he created and what we know about them.
Well, he was... Leonardo learned quite early on that it's by the age of 30 that he couldn't make a living by painting because he was too slow a painter. So he eventually got a job at the Duke of Milan as a kind of chief engineer. And in that role, the first big thing he made himself a name with was to organize a mechanical spectacle. Would you use that word, a spectacle? A spectacle? How would you pronounce it?
Spectacle.
A mechanical spectacle at the occasion of the wedding of the Duke's sister. And we don't have any physical remains of that, just descriptions. But it must have been fantastic. You have to imagine it as a kind of mixture between a planetarium and a theater. You would have the planets revolving and actors declaiming worthy standing on the planets. There are even speculations that some of his flying machines have their origin as pieces for the theater. Now, he later thought of all kinds of robots, of mechanical toys, if you so wish. For example, a lion which could open his chest, which could seemingly tear apart his chest, and with his arm grab into his chest and tear out a bunch of flowers. Just for the enjoyment of the people invited at those parties. So Leonardo seemingly had great talents as an entertainer, and as it is today, technology at that time had an important function in entertaining the people.
One of the things you tell us about Leonardo da Vinci is that some of his ideas were things that perhaps were never more than ideas, that ultimately they never came to full fruition. I mean, things that he designed but ultimately never constructed or never worked out to the extent that they could have finally taken shape and in fact been real. But you tell us we have to be careful in the way that we judge inventors, and that we shouldn't just judge them by how many of their ideas come to fruition. Tell us how this applies to Leonardo da Vinci. How do we judge him as an inventor, keeping this warning of yours in mind?
Well, he's judged, especially by the historians of art, as a brilliant painter, of course, but as a dilettante as an engineer and as a dilettante as a scientist, and I think this is entirely unfair. For two reasons. First of all, we know that Leonardo invented many things that did work, and the Duke of Milan didn't pay him for nothing as an engineer. But what is more important than that, I think that Leonardo coined modern, I think that Leonardo coined many concepts of technology of later times. He had a whole new approach on how to think of a machine, how to make a machine. You see, at that time, technology was done by as it ever was done. That is by the use of tradition. And Leonardo had an entirely new approach. He would try to construct devices systematically from scratch on. And I think in that he made a contribution. I think in devising such approaches, he made a very important contribution. And even if he had realized none of his inventions, he still would remain one of the greatest technologists of all times.
Our last question. What are the most important remaining mysteries or questions surrounding Leonardo da Vinci? I mean, questions that remain to be answered or mysteries yet to be fully revealed?
Yeah, that is a good question. I guess there is much to be revealed how Leonardo thought about astronomy. There is a whole codex, the so-called Codex Arundel, which is hardly understood. This is the question that would interest me most going into. There are many questions, of course, on the more historical, on the more factual side. That is, which machines, for example, did he really build and did he not build? We know astonishingly little about what really was the state of the art at that time. How much ahead was he really? And then, of course, which would make a true sensation, and which I don't think is impossible at all, would be the finding of a whole new codex, a whole new manuscript hidden somewhere. And I think one can hope we will see that one day or another.
So somewhere in a closet or an attic or a basement, there perhaps are more of these lost manuscripts of the great Leonardo da Vinci waiting to be found and studied and shared with the world.
Yeah, I think this is entirely possible.
Stefan Klein's book is Leonardo's Legacy, How Da Vinci Reimagined the World. We're approaching 8:55 here on WGTD. To finish out today's morning show, I'm spending a couple of minutes talking with Nick Berutian, who has been on the program before to talk about the various performances of the Bell Ensemble, which he created several years ago. And their latest project is coming up this Thursday and Friday evening at the Great Hall of the Coven Center in Racine. And it is a performance of Giancarlo Minotti's A Mall and the Night Visitors, his beloved Christmas opera. So, Nick Berutian, just say a quick word about what prompted you to fold this into this current season of the Bell Ensemble.
Well, since the beginning, we've been about collaboration and involving artists and musicians from different parts of the community in programs that are at their core a vocal and choral music presentation, but something more than that too. And 2 years ago, we attempted our first operatic staged production, the small piece La Serva Padrona by Pergolesi, and it went well enough to inspire us to think a little bit bigger. And A Mall and the Night Visitors is also a small work, not as small as you might think, but something that seemed manageable for us this year, and it wasn't manageable for us in previous years. And we finally sort of have the volunteer capacity and the budget capacity and some really great artists, some performers that are really going to make this show wonderful. And, of course, it's a favorite, A Mall and the Night Visitors, to many people, and so we're eager to bring it back to Racine.
Let me give you a minute or so to talk about some of the really outstanding singers that head up your cast, including a marvelous boy soprano as Amal and a marvelous mezzo-soprano as Amal's mother.
Yes, Lucas Alumbreros is a young man. He's the son of Amy Baudersi and Alejandro Alumbreros, two fine local musicians. Amy has sung many times with the Bell Ensemble, and Alejandro very often accompanies us. And so their son Lucas, this is his first time playing a mall, and he's also fairly new to the stage, but he's had some recent great success playing Oliver, and he's just a delight as a mall. So many times you have a beautifully voiced Amal who seems to me a little bit deadpan, and Lucas is anything but deadpan. He's lighting up the stage, and I'm really excited for his role. Erin Sura has also sung with the Bell Ensemble many times. She sings with a lot of groups around our region and in other regions too. Erin is my favorite mother. I mean, and some wonderful mothers, some wonderful sopranos have mezzo sopranos have sung the mother role, but Erin is also such an exquisite actor. She brings a real depth to the character that complements the beautiful melodies that Minotti has given her.
So these are performances that are Thursday and Friday night in the beautiful Great Hall of the De Koven Center. And this is a performance that will be accompanied by chamber orchestra conducted by Nick Berutian, with a really fine cast. And if people want more information about how to purchase tickets, Nick, what should they do?
The best way to get tickets is always to go to the Bell Ensemble website, www.bellensemble.org. At this point, too, there are still, it seems like, plenty of tickets available at the door. And if it gets to the day of the performance, you probably want to just come to the door. There's a phone number, too, that you can call, 262-902-2624, to make sure tickets are available.
Nick Berutian is Artistic Director of the Bell Ensemble, which again performs Giancarlo Minotti's A Mall and the Night Visitors this Thursday and Friday night, January 9th and 10th, at the Great Hall at the De Koven Center in Racine.